He's the poster child of the American dream. I mean,
yeah. On top of a guy who like loves the American dream, loves right. the idea. It's like, this is a dude who grew up in the frontiers, worked his butt off, became financially independent in his early teens, worked his butt off to become a lawyer because he viewed law as a way to increase the social and economic good of a country he loved and he believed in. And now he's 23, gets admitted to the bar after essentially going to night school lawyer. He's basically a night school lawyer. Right. And now he's sitting there and it's like, wow, this guy's 23. And he's funny. He's charismatic. People like being around him and he's brilliant. And this is where he becomes like kind of the American dream, the first prototypical American dream.
Welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep into juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name is Kyle, the Billy to Eric's Steven, and after detouring into America's first war of expansion, we're back on track and about to explain how Alec Baldwin took office.
He does look like Alec Baldwin, dude. No, he does. Oh, my God.
Millard Fillmore. Did you get my intros?
It's a Billy and Steve. It's not like TV show, right? Yeah.
No, it's Baldwin Brothers.
I don't know that much about pop culture. But is this a Stephen Baldwin?
There's a Billy Baldwin. There's another. I think there's a. Is it a Daniel Baldwin, maybe? Or David Baldwin? David. There's a David.
I like the name Billy, and I like the name Steve, but that does not go with the last name Baldwin.
There's a lot of Baldwins. So, how did one become president?
Well, as I bring up my notes, because I low-key started I started liking Millard Fillmore a little more during this, because he's often a forgotten president, right?
Yeah, he's kind of like the same as a Zachary Tyler, but Jonathan Tyler. Tyler at least got to set a precedent, so he kind of gets remembered for that at least.
Yes, I very much agree with that. I do think that one of the interesting parts about Millard Fillmore is he suffers from that curse of like not being elected, right? Like becoming president through vice presidency and then not having a subsequent term. So this creates like kind of like a weird thing where I don't want to say like he doesn't get credit for what he did during it, but because he was unelected, there's always that like, well, you know, you didn't have a mandate, you didn't have this, you didn't have that, because you weren't elected. That you're basically filling the roles that your predecessor left. And okay, like that's fine. Like I'm not against that opinion, and I do think it's a semi-valid opinion. But I think with Millard Fillmore, especially because he inherited it, you know, he inherited such a unique time in U.S. history. And in such a unique arrangement, too, because he inherited the presidency in the highly contentious, you know, in the 1850s, right? And it was during, leading up to the Civil War, slavery was becoming a contentious issue. And he ran with one of, I would argue, of all the presidents when it came to the topic of slavery, one of the most fascinating presidents when it comes to the discussion of slavery.
I would agree with that.
Right, because... Yeah. I keep wanting to say Zachary Taylor. Zachary Taylor. Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
It's the John Tyler throws me off.
I know,
so much.
Me too. Oh, yeah. I'm confused at once.
I'm like, Zach Tyler was never a president. No. That's not a president. But Zachary Taylor had this like really interesting view of slavery that didn't align with anybody, right? Like the South didn't like it because they viewed him as like, well, you know, somebody who was willing to suppress slave owners. Well, he was one of the largest slave owners in Tennessee.
It's almost like he didn't want to own slaves.
He is the prototypical paternalist. Mm-hmm. And so that's weird too, because like, he had all these internal conflictions, but on top of that, he didn't use the U.S. military to, you know, take slaves out of slaves who freed themselves in the Seminole territory. He had these weird opinions on the expansion of Texas into
California.
Basically saying like, I'm gonna go fight people if they want to secede over slavery. So in a weird sense, he's like the, not the anti-Lincoln, like, because that's Buchanan by far, but it's this weird, like,
it's almost like he was antagonizing it.
It was, but he was antagonizing it as a slave owner, and right. where Lincoln, you know, Lincoln's famous quote is like, if I could preserve the Union by freeing all the slaves, I will. If I can preserve the Union by keeping slavery, I will. If I can preserve the Union by freeing some slaves and keeping some slaves, I will. It was that Union. That's a real stance of Lincoln. Now, did that change throughout Lincoln's life? Of course. I'm not trying to say one comment Lincoln made defines his entire character. That's insane. But I think one of the interesting things about Zachary Taylor is that he had kind of those same opinions. I mean, he literally threatened to lead an army down to the South when they wanted to just have a conversation on it, because he's like, no, your conversation's, you know, that's a disingenuous comment. Yeah, it's just addition. So Taylor is this type of president where he gets elected, he has these strong convictions, and he gets elected on as a national hero. A national hero who, you know, redefined military operations, fought America's first war on foreign soil, I would argue. There's definitely an argument to be made, like what we did to Canada and stuff like that, but...
I don't know, he went into the Seminoles, like, deep into Florida and kicked their butts?
Like, unbelievably kicked their butts in their own territory. You know, he had really this aura around him that was kind of unquestionable, and then you mix it in there with the fact that he had this, like, very unionist view. Then he dies. And so you're left with this huge crater of this incredibly popular Whig who ran and had all these really interesting ideas. He had this view on slavery that was like tolerable by the North. I know I'm harping on slavery, but the reason I'm harping on it is because we're in the 1850s in the U.S.
Big deal at this point.
But then Millard Fillmore comes in and there's all this controversy with the Fugitive Slave Act when he takes over. But if we really start from the beginning with Millard Fillmore, he comes from incredibly humble means. And I often wonder if that resonated with Taylor. Because old, you know,
rough and
guts and grits and, you know, old gritty Taylor who loved getting sick with his men in the tents.
Old malaria Mo.
He really develops. I reading about it, they were, you know, sometimes you have political arrangements, right, when it comes to the VP pick. We definitely see that in the postmodern presidents, right? But that existed back then. Politicking has been going on long before the United States was formed. Millard Fillmore, he's born on January 7th, 1800, in New York, in Summer Hill, New York. And he's born into not the gentry class, not upper class, but he's born into humble, you know, I would say humble means.
What was occupation of his parents?
They were just farmers. He had a large family. But they were living in New York's frontier. So they were not in the city. They were, you know, and they weren't kind of where Martin Van Buren was from, which was a little more developed at the time. Like, this is old school frontier New York in the 1800s, in literally 1800.
Yeah,
so, right. So he worked heavy manual jobs when he was a little kid, and he had little limited schooling, very, very heavy labor, and his family constantly was moving because they were searching for stability. The frontier was a dynamic time. They weren't a wealthy family. They were trying to make their own. His family was trying to live the American dream, and they were living it in the frontier.
But they didn't have actual land to them then, sounded like. If they're moving that much, then you obviously don't have, right? Or are you moving because the frontier is tough and you're just trying to find something better?
Kyle, you could literally could not have said it better. So, well, they had, like, land. It wasn't in the sense of having, like, a functioning plantation that was, that you could, you know, sit back and relax on. It was frontier living. So while you had your essentially homestead, you were more moving homestead to homestead than farm to farm. Now, do I want to call it
subsistence?
Yeah. Do I want to call it subsistence farming? No. It was probably just a hair above that. There was an industrial means to it, but it was more within, like, think small village, not, you know, producing an immense amount of tobacco, selling that for money, than buying what you actually want.
This would be like the group of farmers that got together to fund Hershey's milk needs when he opened his factory.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. You're definitely more in that era. So he grew up with very limited education. He received education within the these communities that existed on the frontier, but certainly nothing that we would compare to a Jefferson or a Madison. But he loved it. He loved his early life, and it led to something that would exist throughout Miller Fillmore's entire life. He's a self-studier, man. He is just one of those guys where he wants to learn himself, and that actually really resonated with the public. That was actually considered a very endearing thing about him, is that he was a man of humble means. He was a man who grew up very rough, grew up a lot rougher than the people in the political regimes, rougher than a lot of Americans even at the time. But he ended up he's a very, very intelligent man. He ends up having this work ethic, both physical and mental work ethic, that endeared him to the American people. And, well, he's not. I don't want to make it out to be he's the most popular.
So was he actually healthy, or was he overcompensated for his some other? So this is the first time we had a healthy, industrious president.
He's not James Madison, right? Right. a healthy, industrious president who's doing his own work, not just saying he's industrious.
Right, exactly. Right. Not industrious what's his name?
Pope. Not like every president besides the Adamses at this point. Yeah. Taylor. Taylor grew up rough too. Jackson did too, but he got really, that made him very jaded. Honestly, a lot of Miller Fillmore's life is living through, I would say, worse conditions than Jackson, minus the family tragedies, which I don't want to trivialize that. I'm talking the work ethic side of it, but not turning out to be an intrinsically evil person. I do it. I'm fine calling Jackson evil. Yeah, I'm fine with that. Yeah, I'll die on that hill.
For which part, though?
Jackson?
Yeah, for the terror of abomination, for
stance on slavery, how he treated Native JQA. Americans, JQA, honestly, hitting up my boy wasn't cool. Right. His insistence of acting like a super moral person while having literally no moral compass. I literally cannot figure out, what's up with that dude? Just a weird guy. I feel like he's one of those people we learn about so quick in history, and we see him on the $20 bill. He must have been a great president. It's no, he actually wasn't that great. Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, he got a pretty decent score from us, though.
He's still, there's literally a period called Jacksonian democracy.
I know, right?
You can't. Just because you have a period named after you doesn't mean you're a good person.
Right.
Actually, now that I think of it, do we have periods named after good people?
Darwinian? Is that it? No.
Yeah, we have the Victorian era, but Queen Victoria was who will appear in the script. It's not I mean, I'm pretty sure she's great, but I'm sitting there is she actually a good person or just a good leader? Which I feel sometimes it's hard. I would make the argument that at least from the 1900s onwards, it's hard to say somebody's a lot of the best presidents were not good people.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the example I was giving is Jimmy Carter. It's Jimmy Carter's a great person, individually a great person. It's
but not a great president.
Not a great president. And I don't even feel that's controversial to say anymore.
Is that even his? I mean, is it your fault that nothing really happened while you're president?
I disagree with that, Mr. Kyle.
Well, we haven't gotten that
far. The gas crises and all that stuff.
This wasn't a John Q. Adams where there's nothing left to solve and he was just kind of feet on cruise control.
Lighthouses in the sky and hollow earth. No. You love the hollow earth one. I see that. That reel pops up every so often. I'm just loves that one. That's just his. Because it's so outlandish. Right. And it's even funnier that it's attached to JQA. That would be funny with any president, but it's extra level of comedy when it's JQA doing it. He grows up in. He grows up in this frontier lifestyle. He becomes, he's self-educated. He did, he got school, but he was self-educated, really loved studying. And then when he's in his early teens, around 18, 14, we start seeing records of he's placed in an apprenticeship. And the first thing you want to say is it was a legal apprenticeship, right? That's usually when this is a little early, but maybe he's working a lot. No, he was learning how to make cloth works. That's the term. Nice. Cloth related work.
Okay, so this is more like a JQA, John Adams level of servant.
Yeah, John Adams. JQA was still going to pretty. I mean, at this age, JQA was in Europe working with Ambassador.
Yeah, but like, he also knew how to make shoes, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's a cobbler. I mean, yeah. No, okay, right? Good point. I'll see. Yeah, you're right on that. I'll see that point. And so he becomes an apprentice. He's in, like, I think the best, and this is not a one-to-one example, I think we would refer to this as upholstery work, that type of working with fabrics. Okay. Again, not one-for-one upholstery. I think upholstery is, like, one of, like, the seven original trades or whatever they call it. It is cool.
Like, chairs and stuff, right?
You know, leather working, stuff like that.
Leather, leather working, okay, yeah.
But obviously, that, where do you put the leather, right? Mostly chairs at this time period, too.
Right.
He works hard, and he actually begins, because of his trade he's learning, he becomes commercially industrious. And he begins developing. Now, he's still an apprentice, so it's not like he's, I don't want to make it sound like he's running a business, but at this point, he's independent. For all intents and purposes, like, he's making money for the family. He's
how long did it take him to get to this point?
He's like 15 at this time period.
That's pretty impressive, dude.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. No, dude. Absolutely. I had to check the dates a couple times when I started looking at this. I was like, wow, and it's not like his family sent him off to college or sent him off to, you know, a fixed apprenticeship where he's just sitting there reading. And throughout the time of him working with his hands, building up his businesses, he's still studying. He's very interested in law. And so as he ends up, you know, continuing his industrious work, developing his trade skills, but he starts reading law texts. Anything he can get a hand on, he starts reading it. And he decides he wants to pursue a profession in law. But he didn't want to pursue law because he wanted to be a lawyer. He pursued law because he saw it as a tool to advance the social and economic good of the United States. So he viewed law, so he's about 19 at this point, and he reviews law as basically a system in which can improve the lives of the people of a country or an area.
Was he motivated by politics already at this point then? Was he looking to try to make an effect on his local government?
No, not really. So he's...
just interested?
Yeah. So he has this, I don't want to call it like, infatuation is the word I was looking for. He has this infatuation with this early republic. He loves this idea because he grew up in it. His parents raised him in it, of this idea of like, we are like this republic. And it's like, okay, so the republic exists and the republic is the best form of government. All right, cool. And what is government? Essentially a legal system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, we can use these tools within this great republic we have to advance the social and economic good of people. It's just really unique. He sounds more like a young George Washington, where he's not looking at it like politically. And obviously that will eventually change throughout his life. He'll begin to see, you know, the ability for politics to affect these changes he wants.
Mm-hmm.
So much like Millard Fillmore is throughout his life, he's very systematic in his thought. You'll notice that he's very, very systematic. And by the way, he's a charismatic guy. He's apparently one of the most handsome people in the world, according to Queen Victoria. So you have this...
Well, hang on. Was she just being polite?
Queen Victoria was not known for her decorum, Kyle.
Just from all that I've seen, though, everyone says, seems to think she's pretty devoted to her husband, Prince Albert. I don't know that she necessarily was...
I mean, he looks like Alex Baldwin in the 1850s.
He really does look like Alex Baldwin.
Which,
insane.
I mean, like... That's going to be insane to see. Like, you'd be like, wow, the guy's good looking. because of his style of systematic thought, he ends up, and we'll cover it, but he ends up in next episode, not to foreshadow too much, having this almost Forrest Gump-like life after his presidency. Like, the presidency was like an interesting footnote in his life.
After the presidency.
Oh, yeah. So he humble means he's working with his hands. He's a skilled tradesman at a young age, but he starts getting obsessed with this idea of like, oh, how law can affect things and affect this good change. And so by the time he reaches around early 20s, he finally secures an opportunity to read law under local legal mentors. So basically these frontier lawyers, kind of what Lincoln was-ish. Lincoln, we like to think of Lincoln like as a frontier lawyer. He's more like a frontier judge and lawyer, but it's for a small period. We'll get into, I mean, we're going to do tons of episodes on Lincoln because it's Abraham Lincoln. I mean,
Civil War. We're going to spend a lot of time in the Civil War.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. It's going to be its own, essentially, like its own season.
Yes.
I mean, just like, here, Buchanan's horrible. Then you get the Lincoln. Johnson's horrible. Oh, we, America spent like 150 years underappreciating Grant. That is one. Honestly, you guys can skip season three. Like, Kyle, that's going to be season three.
That's the cliff notes right there.
Is Eric aggressively arguing that Ulysses S. Grant? I'm going to be viciously overcompensating for the fact that Ulysses S. Grant was seen as like a mid-president. And like, I remember growing up and like loving Ulysses S. Grant and like not being able to figure out why people didn't like him. I'm just like, what? Why does this guy not get more props? And people are just, like, apathetic. And then, like, as, like, time progresses and people, like, revisit. You know, when I was growing up, people were like, Woodrow Wilson was a great president. And I'm like, he, like, was, but he's not really. Like,
right.
Yeah. Like, you know, growing up and hearing, like, certain presidents would be like, oh, this person was great. Like, I remember growing up and people thought Andrew Jackson was great. And I remember being, like, getting books on the presidents. Like, when I was a little kid, I had the books on every president. I read all of them. And I'm just like, why do we like this dude? Like, just show me a redeeming quality. It's like, well, he stuck by Secretary Eaton on the Peggy Eaton affair. I'm like,
okay.
He also genocided people.
Yes, he ignored the Supreme Court.
Yeah, he was just a piece of
overthrew sovereign governors.
Yeah, like, he was just, and then fought a battle that didn't matter. Though I will say, I've retracted that. That 100%. It didn't matter to the U.S. war. That commenter, I mean, I really wish you would reach out to us because we will send him merch.
That's a good comment, yeah.
That was just a good comment, dude. That was just an intelligent comment, and I love it. It definitely freaked out the Brits a little bit. You're like, oh, my God. But so as he enters his 20s, he starts studying under these mentors, and he still worked with his hands. He was still a tradesman, and he would use this money to support him, to support his family. All his mentors would reference that he was an insatiable reader. Mm-hmm. Like, this man could just read through anything, and he loved it. He was one of those people who just can consume information. It's funny. I had an uncle who passed away way too young, but he would go on vacation and he'd bring like 7 books, and it was unbelievable to watch him because he could read 7 books at a time. And I'm like the way I would flip through different shows to watch, he would flip between books. I'm like, how is your brain structured that way? And he was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant.
I don't know about 7 books, but I used to juggle 3 or 4 at a time.
I don't know how anybody juggles 2 books. I think that's an insane thing.
What?
Like, really? Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, God, I love you people. To me, that's such a huge sign of intelligence. But he also starts, as he, you know, is being industrious, he starts getting exposed to non-legal literature, and he finally has time to read and consume stuff he didn't have the opportunity growing up in such a, you know, a frontier heavy labor lifestyle, right? Yeah. And it's very clear to his mentors, it's very clear to people who talk to him, that he's this humble, hardworking guy who's brilliant, who's just like, oh wow, you're just like, you know, it's rare, but we run into people like this in life where you're just like, oh, you're working insanely hard on top of like, oh, you're a genius, like you're just right? Smarter than people. And
was he one of those unassuming types, like that? Is just, they don't speak very often, but whenever they do, it's always right.
Yeah, he's like, I could not find anything of him, but you know, like cocky or anything like that. Everything I've read, especially his post presidency, he's just like charismatic as hell. He's a good time to be around. He's right. Like, you know, he's the O negative of personality. That is, everybody likes him. Like, right. It's why he has so much interesting success in his post presidency of doing all these cool things, because people are like, oh, he's funny. Apparently, he's like he's like kind of like really smart goofball where he enjoys conversation on anything. He's so well read. And he knows so many things, and he doesn't have a chippy personality, that he could sit at the table, he could go to Japan, he could go to England, he could tour Europe, and just hold court with people, because they're like, oh, he's a fun guy to be around, he's goofy, nothing offends him, he doesn't come from this aristocratic lifestyle, he has to know, like, which fork to use and stuff like that. And he was also president at one point, so you can't even be like, you need to attain to this higher lifestyle. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, president was my highest title. It's like, all right, cool. Never mind. And all right. By the time he becomes president, don't forget, we already covered the Mexican-American War. By the time he's president, this ain't some backwater nation anymore.
Right, yeah.
This is a nation running around with an amazing navy that the, you know, there's a reason we haven't fought a war with the Brits.
War of 1812?
Yeah, since the War of 1812, some random skirmishes. But there's a reason the rest of the world's like, this is when the U.S. is like, you'd be sick. What if we just had a navy? It's like, oh. Well, you only have water.
You already beat Britain twice without one, so yeah. God knows what you'll do with one.
And it's funny, because everybody was like, U.S., you only have one coastline. Why do you need that? And they're like, oh, one coastline? It's like, well, yeah, Spain owns the other side. Spain and Russia and Britain own the other side. Like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, yeah.
Hold on.
What if they didn't? It's like, what do you mean, what if they didn't? That's like, that's a territory. It's like, I do love, something cool about America is like, how did we expand? The biggest way we expanded is we just bought stuff.
Right, right.
Like, I just find that cool. It's like, yeah, right. We fought wars to expand. Absolutely. I'm not dismissing that. But the majority of land we got was like, here you go.
And then we sold it to ourselves.
Yeah, it's a bunch of money. Like, I don't know why I like that. Like, it's a bunch of, right. I like that there's many wars we fought where we won and then bought the land from the country afterwards, which is so funny to me. Like, right. I don't know why I thought, we beat you. So yeah, here's $15 million. It's like, oh, that. But you beat me. So he ends up building all these connections because he's working with these – he's mentoring under these attorneys in New York in the 1810s and 1820s. Many of his mentors would go become part of the political machine that end up turning to New York. So what do they remember? They remember this hardworking kid who could, you know, make his money with trades, was brilliant, consumed tons of legal material, had this ethos of like the greater ideal of the republic. Like, how do you not like the guy?
So you could be in a scenario where the guy who's defending you in court was also the same guy who upholstered your carriage.
Yeah, could you imagine being like, I need a suit and then a lawyer, and he's like, you're not gonna believe this.
I got you both.
But
a nice chair to sit on.
Yeah, no, exactly. He's like, this guy's awesome. I love this guy. So 1823 rolls around. He finally gets admitted to the bar. And he's admitted to New York. He does it through the apprenticeship program, which at this time most attorneys, especially in the North, they became attorneys. This is like 1823. So many of these people he mentored under, they're not prominent yet. They're not part of the machine yet. So he's just a self-made guy. He's like working hard, doing everything. He's considered a very well-versed attorney. He's considered very competent. He's like all those things that made him successful in his trade as a tradesman made him a successful attorney. And this is the first, I always love that term, the first seed of that self-made public servant perception that people will get about him.
Dude, he's the poster child of the American dream. I mean,
yeah. On top of a guy who like loves the American dream, loves right. the idea. It's like right. he's a guy who didn't grow up in the aristocracy, didn't grow up with all the, you know, didn't have slaves running his plantation. This is a dude who grew up in the frontiers, worked his butt off, became financially independent in his early teens, worked his butt off to become a lawyer because he viewed law as a way to increase the social and economic good of a country he loved and he believed in. And now he's 23, gets admitted to the bar after essentially going to night school lawyer. He's basically a night school lawyer. Right. And now
before
he's sitting there.
Night law schools existed too.
Yeah. And now he's sitting there and it's like, wow, this guy's 23. And he's funny. He's charismatic. People like being around him and he's brilliant. And this is where he becomes like kind of the American dream, the first prototypical American dream, where he's like, I came from the frontier. I came from my family not having a stable place to live. And I worked my butt off. I worked with my hands. And now I'm working at law. And I don't have all the credentials. But look how much in 23 years I elevated my right. life. He's like, and he's doing this thing like, this is what makes America great. Which is, when you read about Millard Fillmore, he's a forgotten president. He's 100% a forgotten president.
Why? Yeah.
But he gets a little bit of the William Henry Harrison vibes of being like, oh crap, was this guy like actually like great? Was this actually a great? And I hate saying William Henry Harrison because slavery, removing the slavery side, which we should never just like fully discount that. But what I'm saying is that idea of starting from very, very rough beginnings and transitioning to, and obviously Millard Fillmore, it's a lot more impressive because he didn't rely on literally owning people to do it. But that progression, that ability of Millard Fillmore to lift himself up, and want to lift himself up, not just for monetary success, but because he truly believed in the idea of the republic. And he's not doing this as a founding father. This is 1800. He was born in 1800. So this is him believing in what was already formed.
Right, right. Born in 1800. I mean, this is... If anything wants to show that this is a meritocracy, I think this guy is the poster child of that.
Yeah. And so 1826 rolls around, and so it's just after his 26th birthday, he meets Abigail Powers, who's a former teacher, and she's just as ferociously intellectually curious as Bella Fillmore.
Is she named after another famous Abigail?
No, she would have been born a little too early before Abby became our the best founding mother became famous. But so they're still living in upstate New York, and they have this really cool relationship where he views Abigail not just as his partner, but as intellectual peer. And they have and they both share this idea of like the great American experiment, this meritocracy idea. And they have a really funny relationship, which is endearing to people who were around them, where they love not like arguing, debating, but they would just talk about every topic imaginable. And people really gravitated towards that. And some historians you read about, some historians like using this term called a reform-minded world. That's what they shared. And remember, this is upstate New York in the 1820s. There's many different cultures mixing. I mean, obviously Martin Van Buren, we can think of him, who spoke Dutch as his first language. So there's this heavy immigrant population. The state of New York is... I don't believe they've outlawed slavery at this point, but have made slavery effectively illegal by this point. So this idea of like kind of the first idea of the melting pot we'll see all these different cultures coming in here. Well, you got to imagine all these cultures are moving in. They're all heavy, very trades driven. And now they have this attorney. They have this attorney who grew up just as rough as they did, who has a very bubbly personality, very likable guy. Mm-hmm. Who's incredibly well-read, so he's going to go talk to these immigrants. He knows already about them. He's read all the literature. He knows all these great things. You kind of start seeing why the public life starts encroaching on him, not necessarily because he wanted it, but because...
He's just good at it.
He's just good at it, and people like him. So he marries Abigail in 1826. They have a great household. He loves his family responsibilities, and he has all these professional ambitions. And Abigail's so supportive of it. She's not a quiet wallflower sitting behind the scenes, but she does love it. And what we start to see is this steady advancement, where he just. And I don't want to say success doesn't find him. He finds success, but he starts climbing the legal ladder. And as he's not stepping on necks to do it. It's just something where he's naturally gifted at it. He's good at it. He has an amazing wife supporting him. And
he's a good consensus builder too.
Oh yeah, he's a big consensus builder. Yeah. Oh yeah, but we start seeing some primary sources describe him as respectable, and like. At that time point, that's a good compliment today. But at that time point, that carries a lot more weight. It carries weight that people view him as honest. They view him as a fair trader. But they also view him as somebody you look up to. Calling somebody respectable back then was basically saying he is somebody we should hold our ideals to.
He's a role model. It's almost like saying a hero.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And he has this emphasis on institutional order. So he is what we would call, in economics, we refer to certain groups of economists or even certain groups of political scientists as institutionalists. I love institutionalism. I don't know if I would be considered an institutionalist. I think institutions are incredibly important. I think we should view economics through the lens of institutions in a sense to how they apply to economic activity.
I've heard people say that maybe you should be institutionalized, but that's
that is what my doctor says a lot. And I was like, no, I'm more of an Austrian, and then usually gives me a prescription. So this idea of that the institutions of the Republic, I don't want to use the word sacred because I didn't find anything in Millard Fillmore discussing them that way, as quote-unquote sacred, but viewing the institutions as apolitical entities that can uplift people. Again, I'm always going to keep going back to his view of social and economic progression.
Did anybody ever view them as being sacred like that, though? I mean, because that seems like a weird... Like, we're still pretty close to the war that was fought to liberate us from things that were maybe more held towards that type of mindset.
Yeah, I would say idealized is what the founding fathers did. And I think sometimes as idealism fades, it becomes sacred.
Now we got to figure out how to do it. You either got sacred or you got the realist. How are we going to make this thing work for ourselves, or we're going to idealize it?
Okay. Yeah. And I think he viewed these institutions as being able to promote change, but just because you promote change as an institution doesn't mean you have to change the institution. The institution should be built in a way that moves you. It's kind of like an elevator. You don't move the elevator moves you, right? Like,
well, and the more you learn about the way everything's been set up here, you see that it's a living document. It's all designed to change. Like, once you guys get a firm understanding of that, maybe that empowers you to try to push for some of that stuff.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And Kyle, so that's why he starts transitioning into politics.
Yeah.
So in his late 20s and early 30s, his legal career starts really taking off. And he ends up building out an entire law practice. And at this point, the Whigs start to appear. Now, it's important to remember, the Whigs are fascinating because when we look at the different political parties that existed throughout the history of the United States, very small percentage of them ever had a president elected. In fact, when we look at political parties, it's really only about four. Four or five. You can get subjective on here because what was John Quincy Adams? He was kind of a national Republican in a sense.
He was kind of his own thing, I mean, wasn't he?
But yeah, but he was originally elected as a Democratic Republican. So like I think it's weird. Sometimes I see people be like, oh, he was he was more of a national Republican. Well, he didn't win on that ticket. You had the Federalists, right? You had George Washington, ran as no party in the first term, Federalist second, John Adams. You have the Democratic Republicans. And then the National Republicans, I would argue, never had an elected president. I think there's a fair argument. Like, I could see somebody retroactively assigning the title of National Republican to John Quincy Adams, but I think that's only a product of Jacksonianism that occurred after the election. Like, literally, it was the election that caused it. So it's weird to like, Like, it doesn't make sense to retroactively define it that way.
He didn't run on that ticket or platform. He just,
Yeah, then you have the Whigs. Then we're done. Then it's Democrats and Republicans since 1860. So the Whigs, the Whig Party starts, percolating. You have all these proto-Whigs walking around. They don't know what they are. Are they National Republicans? Are they not? Because they're not. If you look at the National Republican platform, you look at the Whig platform, you could see why somebody, a voter, may switch between them. But they're different platforms. They are different platforms, and certainly there was a large wing of the National Republicans that absorbed into the Whigs. I mean, they're literally called the Whigs because they're anti-Jackson. I get it. But as Fillmore starts maturing in his political identity, he became very active in local civic affairs. Mm-hmm. He started blurring that line, like many attorneys at the time, many of these pre-Civil War attorneys started doing, where they're blurring the line between being an attorney and being a politician. And this is where he gets interesting. This is where he gets really interesting. He starts self-discovering that he's a Whig. And it really comes down to four major points that a lot of historians point to. And this fits Millefort perfectly. He didn't join the Whig Party because he saw political opportunism and then worked his belief system back. He had a belief system that matched the Whigs. And particularly the four major points were congressional supremacy. He was the support for congressional supremacy, which is literally why the Whigs were formed. Economic development, banking stability, and internal improvements. So, as you could be, literally, you can't be any more anti-Jackson.
I was just going to say. How did he come about to these realizations? Is there any writings on that, or
I don't know. So there's no writing on him having this eureka moment. They may exist. I just want to be clear. They may exist. I mean, if anybody finds, let me know, because I'm really curious. Kyle, you and I, same curiosity.
Yeah.
Doing my homework on this, I'm like, it feels like he naturally arrived at these conclusions, and I think part of it was seeing the turmoil of Jackson, because he is so different than Jackson, the way he views stuff. Oh my, it really is. For two attorneys that practiced during the same time in the same country, wow, not even remotely close.
Right,
So he ends up, kind of advance. He ends up finding the Whigs align with him very well. And during the, as he's discovering his political feat, he ends up joining the, point of clarity here. He participated in the anti-Masonic movement. I don't know if he was a member. I don't believe he was a member.
Like the Freemasons?
Yeah, there was this movement, the anti-Masonic movement, which is basically long story short, but it basically was opposing this like the quote unquote secret society of the Masons, and it heavily emphasized like moral reform and transparency. So it was this idea of like removing. I don't want to like, again, I'm not an expert on, my grandfather was a Mason, which is ironic because I was on my mom's side, so her last name's not Mason. And then like my last name's Mason, so that's like, that's kind of funny, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. And Masons don't allow Catholics to join, and like, so I'm a Mason who can't be a Mason.
Right.
That's funny. I think it's kind of funny. That's a little funny. Yeah, I think so. But they kind of viewed the Masons as this like aristocratic class. I know that's a bad term. I could probably,
was it like the Illuminati thing, the way people view that?
Yeah,
today,
I guess you want to be comical, but yeah, it was this like restrictive it was this restrictive class.
Was that, just a faceless boogeyman that?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Masons now is just like it's like the Elks. It's like a place you go and like have a few beers and have like a social club. But that's not what they viewed it back then. And a lot of the founding fathers were Masons, and it was kind of seen as like, are we forming a new class of aristocrats who joined this Mason movement? So he was very anti it, but his efforts and connections he made in the anti-Masonic network, they basically functioned as a stepping stone into the Whig coalition.
So this is interesting that you mentioned like the anti-Mason, I guess, kind of mentality, or you mentioned like the classes or the elitism. Like this is something that like Laura and I were talking about, like we're kind of reading up a little bit, but like I guess the founding fathers didn't really want to, or didn't think they were going to not have like a wealthy class or an elite class. I think the main thing was just that it should be open to anybody.
That's exactly
not
what
be,
it was.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody's, I mean, that, yeah, exactly. Because like if you don't think there's going to be a wealthy class,
of the people writing the government's rule were from a wealthy class, right? So
they're
going to
definitely
protect themselves.
Yeah, it's like educating can read. You're at a period where there's not a lot of education and reading, you're going to be wealthier.
But it's interesting that I guess that, so there's a movement against the elite class when really, like, what are they against, I guess, at the point? Is it just the exclusivity of it or the...
Yes, that's what it was. It was like, you have to be part of this club to be elite, as opposed to, can you just lift yourselves up to be elite?
Right.
Which is what, essentially, which is not a surprise that Millard Fillmore would be against this. He's like the poster child of being anti this.
But, I mean, it's also like the how do you point to him? How is he successful if you have to be part of this club to be successful?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's meritocracy.
Yes.
So his work in the anti-Masonic network really fueled his entry into the public life, which, and he would win a congressional seat in 1832. So he would serve, he won an election to the U.S. rep, and this really transitioned him from being a regional figure well-known in upstate New York and some fringe areas of modern New England into being on the national stage. He wins election, he enters Congress, and this is during Jackson's presidency. So guess you can pretty much guess where he fell in that line. And so he not only positioned himself in the early Whig Party, but he positioned himself very clearly and directly as an anti-Jackson. He did not shy away from that. He did not try and act like he's anti-Jackson to be part of the Whigs. He was just like, hey, I believe in, I believe in like national internal improvements, banking stability, and Congress being in charge. Because you know who also believed in Congress being in charge? The founding fathers. That's why it's Article 1.
Right. the president doesn't have supreme power over everything?
Yeah. Right. So as the Whig Party starts, the Whig Party is now starting to form a real party, right? It's all that cosmic dust now starting to form a planet. And he aligns the Whigs on economic modernization. There's a term that popped up in some of the pieces I was reading on him. Mm-hmm. He was a big supporter of predictable credit. I was like, that's so far ahead of your time in the 1830s, being like, guys, we need to have a predictable credit system because that's going to allow industry to flourish. And the dude saying that is some guy who in his early teens was able to use his skills to start commercial enterprises and then became a lawyer. Like, I kind of want to listen to that guy. That guy seems pretty smart when it comes to knowing what people need.
Did he study economics too? Because it sounds like he's got a pretty good grasp.
No, we don't really have what we'd consider modern, like what we'd consider economics, right? Because A Wealth of Nations
hadn't really come about yet.
Yeah, it's 1776. So you start right now in the 1830s, you start having like Robert Malthus and those guys pop up, proto-microeconomics. But no, the idea of like Keynesianism, like this, that's a macro idea, is 1920s.
Right, right.
Like, I don't think people realize how new macroeconomics is. Like, it's very, very, very new. It's like the radio is older than macroeconomics.
I think it was Robert Solow, the guy that...
Like,
he just recently passed away. Like, you could have seen him, like, do a presentation, like, literally 2 years ago.
So while he's in Congress, he really becomes a supporter, and this should be no surprise to anybody, of legislative process and institutional restraint. So he has this very strong skepticism of the expansion of executive power. He believes that executive power will be a runaway expansion if it's allowed to occur. No. And executive power has been a runaway expansion since Jackson. That is up until Nixon, we had the War Power Acts. Yeah. And it never really came back to what the Founding Fathers wanted it to be.
Right.
So he, and Kyle, you mentioned it earlier. So his whole political style was all emphasized committee work, statutory detail, and what is often described as a coalition of compromise. He hated this idea of like everybody who's a Whig has to believe one thing. He hated this idea of like everybody can only be defined as one ideology in this
no identity politics. Purity against test. That?
Yeah. And so at this time, it was either you're anti-Jackson or you're supportive of Jackson. And what's funny, because he's a charismatic, likable guy, but he ended up in Congress having a reputation as a diligent legislator rather than one of the charismatic, hey, follow me, congressmen. Which is funny, because he is, by all accounts, a fun guy to be around who's wicked smart. Because he was diligent, because he focused on the details, and because he could build committees of very disagreeable men, on top of it, it's one thing to build a committee. That's impressive. It's another thing to build a coalition. That is really impressive. And he was able to construct these across party lines while still never abandoning his fundamental beliefs and the Whig Party platform. So he ends up, he served additional terms in the U.S. House up until like 1843. So he ends up bouncing between like his law practice when he was in Congress but ends up coming back in 1837. So he serves a term.
During the panic.
Yeah, right. Right. Like, this is like the panic of 1837.
Yep.
So he ends up coming back 37 to 43. So he wins in 1836. Remember, it's a House, so it's 2-year terms.
Yeah.
And by the time he returns, the Whig Party really became the dominant counterparty to the Jacksonian era Democratic Party.
Kind of solidified their ideology. They've gotten some candidates elected.
Exactly. But the nation at this point, when he runs 1836, has divided between you're either a Jacksonian or you're not a Jacksonian. And it's tribalism has never been one.
Right.
He ends up becoming very well respected on both sides because he was not a grandstander. He was not a filibusterer. He was not, somebody who climbed on a soapbox and spoke of ideology. But he was a man who believed in the Republic ideals. Nobody questioned his sincerity and belief in the Republican ideals. Quick thing, Republican ideals. I'm talking about the United States, right? The Republican Party doesn't exist yet.
I'm just going to record a snippet of that so you can just say play the disclaimer.
Yeah, honestly, play the disclaimer. Right. But as he works in these legislative committees, and as he really starts to develop who he is as Millard Fillmore, as this who he is on the national circuit for his identity, he's known for being able to build to work across these party lines because he has a near encyclopedic command of legislative work, both in what the law says, how the law is applied, but how to maneuver yourself throughout the word of law.
And he's like a Madison.
Oh yeah, he's
right.
Not far off from that. But during the Panic of 1837 and the subsequent race to figure out how to recover, his strong point is fiscal and administrative matters. So as we start talking about the Walker Act, we start talking about the things that we're trying to deal with in the in the Panic of 1837, they're looking at a guy who in 1832 was like, we need predictable credit. It was like, what was one of the biggest causes? They're looking at like, oh, we have this horrible 25% fiscal shortfall because of the Species Acts, and we can't figure out how to agree on anything. So you look at this guy over there, he's like, well, he called the credit thing. Like, anybody politically charged on international credit? It's like, no, that's not something to be politically charged about. All right, we're fiscally screwed. Oh, that really smart guy that everybody likes hanging out with, he also knows a lot about that. Oh, how is he good with figuring out ways to get through Congress? Well, he can build coalitions out of people who hate each other. It's like, can we talk? Is he able to talk to?
He's busy.
is he busy? So he ends up, serving through the early 1840s. He rises to prominency through committee leadership.
Is there any prominent legislation that had his name attached or that he pushed through during this time?
So he was I don't want to say hesitant, but he was often – that wasn't his style. He wasn't like, this is the Bill of Fillmore Act.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it was about that coalition building. And but by this point, it just perfectly coincides with the rise of the Whigs. And his profile increased as the Whigs really – hit their apex in national power in the early 1840s. Mm-hmm. But by the mid-1840s, he's out of Congress. You know, he's back working as law practice. But he's still very much a Whig. By this point, it's hard. It's almost like a lot of the Whig ideals are products of Millard Fillmore's ability to move legislation. So he kind of becomes part of the Whig ethos, not because he did it to become a Whig to help his political career, but because he... deep down inside, believed in these things long before the Whig Party existed, and he was incredibly effective in the legislative branch. So he ends up with this prominent role in the Whigs Party.
So it's like he basically made them what they were.
Yeah, and the Whig Party. Well, we can all talk about the first national campaigners for the Whigs and stuff like that. They are New York, which should have been firmly Whig, had so many. It's like the law of dissimilarity, where things that are so similar, people look for differences, and that causes more fractures. So New York is a very fragile state when it comes to with all the different Whig factions. Every Whig faction loved him. Every Whig faction was great with him. And as we go into the territorial expansion of the 1840s, and we start talking about the slavery issue starts really percolating through as America begins to question its own soul, its own ideals of its republic.
Right.
This begins to reshape the political environment, and Fillmore's moderations would be tested during this process because he is a man of conviction. He's a man who believes in what he believes, but he's also a man who knows that sometimes compromise is necessary as much as it challenges your own identity.
Mm-hmm.
And he stays local in 1847, which is the last office he'll be elected to, which is New York State Comptroller, which I just think it's cool that we have him.
Right.
Right. Why is that cool to me? It's like, not New York governor.
Isn't that backwards?
State Comptroller. What's that?
Isn't that going backwards from Congress?
Oh, I don't know. See, Eric thinks being a state comptroller would be super cool. Like, I think it's cool to talk to congressmen. I think that's interesting. I think that's interesting. But if you were like, Eric, who do you want to go to dinner with? A congressman or a comptroller, a state comptroller? I'd be like, state comptroller. That's so cool. But then again, I'm not those, the litmus test.
It's also, probably only 50 of those compared to 400, whatever.
435 congressmen.
Yeah, this is rare.
Yeah. And he really got to flex his muscle of... he's an administrative man. He can run things. He strengthens New York's fiscal. Like, he reinforces administrative control. He brings in really strong institutional oversight because, again, he believes in institutions. But he believes institutions have to be unbiased. They can't be opinionated. By this point, the people are like, wow, this dude knows how to run these public systems. He's like the opposite of, an ideologue. Like, he's viewed as this. As just a competent and industrious, hardworking public servant, the opposite of a bureaucrat.
It's been a bit of a theme, it seems like, right? It seems like we seem to want to get a hardworking, competent person who can manage the bureaucracy, and then they die early, and then we get replaced with some garbage. But this time, we might have some hope.
We might have some hope.
Because Miller Fillmore is really shaping up to be something cool.
Yeah. So, he ends up riding, obviously, he's very prominent in New York. He's been prominent in New York at this point for almost 20 years. He's a congressman. He's a state comptroller. And the Whigs are looking around, and they see Zach Taylor, and they're like, oh, this is going to be a good guy to run. Right. Well, you got to have this. And we covered it in the last series. And so they're excited for the Zach Taylor, but they need a, quote, safe Whig who, remember, you want to run Zach Taylor. Mm-hmm. He's the largest slaveholder in Tennessee. He's a war hero. He's somebody who's seen as a beloved military figure who practiced restraint on the battlefield while also innovating
another warfare. Good administrator.
Yep. But they're like, we need to run him with somebody. If we run him with a Southern Whig, we're going to lose New York, which is, an immense amount of electoral votes. So they're like, where's the guy who New York won't just vote against it? Remember, the Whig Party at this point is not like the Jacksonian Democrats. They're not united at all. There are Southern Whigs and Northern Whigs, and they kind of don't get along. So as they form the ticket, Miller Fillmore is seen as, Taylor. Let me start with Taylor. I should start with the president. I hate when I do that. I've done that a couple times on the show where I'll talk about presidential tickets and start with the vice president. I'm like, why am I doing that? That's so weird.
We talked about the president last episode.
No, right? Okay. That's why I'm doing it.
It's fine in this situation.
Yeah. So Miller Fillmore, Miller Fillmore supplied the party credentials. Whigs believed he was a Whig. Yeah. Never owned a slave, not from a slave-owning area, from a melting pot area, meritocracy, brought him up by shoelaces. He has tons of governing experience. And people are looking at New York and they're like, oh my God, like the best run state at the time, besides Massachusetts. Massachusetts will always be better than New York. So I don't even know if that's true, by the way. I have no idea if that's a factual statement, but I'm sticking by it. Yeah.
Argue it in the comments.
Yeah, he did these reforms. Made New York strong fiscally, made it strong administratively. He's working Congress. He's basically seen as like kind of almost like a mystic. Like, how did you get everybody to agree on stuff? Because he was like, I didn't get everybody to agree on it. I didn't make you have to compromise all your beliefs. No, we've got to attach each issue. I mean, at the end of the day, by this point, this is 1848, right? 1847 when they really start putting this ticket together. Nomination came in 1848. People are looking back and be like, yo, so he was really right about that whole credit discussion and fiscal and all that stuff. So people are like, oh, he's a good administrator, knows what's going on. Taylor, widespread electoral appeal. He's the hero of the Mexican-American War. He's somehow, is a hero of the Mexican-American War, but, practiced a ton of restraint. So, people see me as, noble, and then how he handled Chief Blackhawk. And then, at this point, the frontier areas that Taylor oversaw is now, developing. So, all those people in those borderline states that are, slave states are in the South too, are like, oh damn, that guy managed a lot of stuff and was like super successful in helping us. And so Taylor has this huge acclaim. Bill Fillmore is like, you literally can't find a better administrator.
How much input did Zachary Taylor have on the selection of Millard Fillmore? Do we know?
I'm very curious about this because from what I understand from Zachary Taylor's standpoint is that he was a very easy to get along with, and he understood the delicacy of the vice president pick within the Whig Party, especially in the 1840s. And Zachary Taylor's always proven to be a very competent delegator. He doesn't shy away or shirk responsibility, but he understands that there are people who are better when it comes to this stuff. Like, he was a man who would call the cannons, but not tell the cannons how to fire. And that, I think that was his attitude at the convention. He's like, I understand. Now, I'm telling you right now,
the reason why I ask is because I'm kind of getting the impression that, like you mentioned, he's a good delegator, so he didn't really have a political ideology when he took office. He was just kind of an administrator who just did what he thought was right. It sounds to me like Miller Fillmore was his guy that might have been the one that had the ideology that he wanted to enforce or push.
Yeah, and I do very much agree with that. So I don't have a direct primary source on this, some dude taking notes. But from all I can find is that
They seem pretty aligned.
And again, Miller Fillmore is not the type who would sit there and even though he clearly opposed slavery, in his personal life. I mean, as we kind of foreshadowed a little bit, his idea of coalition building always requires compromise. And I don't want it to sound like I'm saying he compromised on his position on slavery, because he didn't. Mm-hmm. But he was not an ideologue, and he understood that little steps forward are better than standing on a soapbox. Do you know what can't move forward? A soapbox.
Right.
And he very much understood that. I could not see Zachary Taylor Mill from not getting along. Like, they are just like so much the same on stuff. So Milford Moore would, obviously, he'd run in the 1848 election as vice president. Obviously, running with Zach Taylor, it's a huge win. It kept the Northern Whig coalition together, kept the Whig party together, and, you know, again, and was able to successfully enter the second highest spot in the land. Mm-hmm. Did Noah Fillmore think he was going to be president as soon as he became president? No, I think he was probably excited to be vice president. I think he was probably like, I love congressional supremacy. I'm going to be the head of the Senate. I'm the vice president. I think he was probably excited. He's working with a non-ideological president, somebody who's able to work on both sides, who has this immense reputation of being this great general, who is a unionist as all gets out. So obviously, Bill Fillmore's an institutionalist. You know what? He loves the Republic. So he's probably like, this is going to be great. I'm going to have a blast. I'm this administrator. He ran for state comptroller, not state governor. He clearly likes the administration side. As we know, it doesn't go that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think maybe he hadn't finished reading up to like John Adams and realizing why the vice president spot got nerfed?
He
gets into the job like, man.
This stinks. But unfortunately, Millard Fillmore's presidency, it's going to test many of these core fundamental beliefs that he held. And we will see Millard Fillmore struggle through his presidency of trying to keep the Union together while building a coalition of two things that just can't exist anymore together. Mm. But we'll cover that next episode.
All right. I think that's a good spot to end things for part one. So please, please, please join us next week as we see how the sexiest man alive conducts foreign policy. And while you're waiting for that, jump into the comments. Give us your best theories for why Mr. Fillmore looks so much like Alec Baldwin. You can also email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com if you're too shy. Resurrect those thumbs, subscribe on your way out, visit the website to stay up to date, and we'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.